Disclaimer. Today's episode is a bit heavy and super dark. Yeah, babies, it turns out this episode of Lucky's really long list of movies will actually be more of a true crime podcast rather than a movie-watching podcast. So I only want you to join me today if you are open to hearing this story containing heavy themes like murder, rape, victim blaming, and sexual violence against a minor. Yeah. It's Lucky's Really Long List of Movies, a true crime podcast. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Lucky's Really Long List of Movies. I know, my vibes might be off today. I might seem a bit boiled down, but that is because I am currently recovering from the absolute roller coaster I just threw myself on when researching this week's movie. Why did I say it so weird? Darlings, this week we are covering the 1968 blockbuster Rosemary's Baby. I put this movie on my list because I hear about it all the time. It's referenced everywhere, like in American Horror Story. That first season, which is my favorite season, that first season has a huge Rosemary's Babies like plot in it. And now the name Tate is looking a bit specific. But I'm going to try to not get ahead of myself so quickly. For starters, I was really afraid to watch Rosemary's Baby because the people who talked about it seemed really afraid of it or like very disturbed by it. Anytime someone makes a Rosemary's Baby reference in front of me, you know, I have to do the whole, I haven't seen it, like song and dance. But instead of telling me, you haven't seen it, the person would kind of get whale-eyed and be like, you haven't seen Rosemary's Baby? And then the conversation would just be left at that. Like they didn't want to ruin my innocence or something. Or maybe I was just picking up on something super disturbing and then my imagination was going wild because it's like, what was it about this movie that made people so uncomfortable? What happens? It's from the 60s. PG-13 wasn't even invented yet. Oh my God, it's a lawless state of time. I don't know. It freaked me out. And it was safe to say I was very scared to watch this movie. Yeah. I had no idea what this movie was about. I know, what's new? So, I thought this movie would be a perfect addition to our Halloween category, and I definitely got more than I bargained for. Okay, so this week, I'm going to make an exception, and I'm going to forego the one-minute recap for a couple of reasons. I know everyone's probably cheering and celebrating, but I'm sad. I don't want to do like a silly one-minute recap because, one, the plot is very simple, but the themes are really heavy. And I felt weird being like a little clown about the plot of this movie. And also, you'll see why by the end of this show. So, without further ado, on to the totally normal speed recap that will probably also take a minute or less. So the plot. Okay, so a couple, Rosemary and Guy, that's the name of the couple. Rosemary's the wife, Guy is the husband. They move into an apartment building and they have these weird and wonderfully dressed neighbors. Turns out the wonderfully weird dressed, actually elderly neighbors, are Satan worshippers who have made a deal with Guy, the husband. The deal? Well, to basically sacrifice his wife and child in the name of Satan so he can have a really good acting career. The husband, Guy, not Satan. His wife wasn't killed, but she was drugged and then raped by the devil in a ritual led by the not-so-wonderful elderly neighbors. And Rosemary gives birth to the son of Satan while questioning her sanity. In the end, she agrees to assist in raising the child. The end. Ta-da! Yay. Okay, so now on to my first take of the movie. Okay, so once again, I'm going to play my first take off my phone. Y'all, it's so damn hot. It is so damn hot. It is a miracle that I can record these episodes during this heat wave New York is having. And I'm so nauseous and I'm on my period, literally the period from hell, on theme. Oh my God, I'm so nauseous. One sec. Okay. Whew. Woof. Where are my PMDD girlies at? Oh my God. Okay. So, oof. I know I'm screwing with the continuity here and letting you know that I record these bad boys in advance, but I'm a big lady and I want to complain about the goddamn heat. My skin is so sticky. All right. Okay, I found the clip.
This is my first day. I want to be lazy. No, I'm not lazy. It's just hot as hell outside.
It is.
It's really hot.
It is.
That was nuts. Was not expecting it to be about witches. I honestly was expecting disturbing stuff. Okay, so when the baby was in the bassinet, like the devilish bassinet, I thought that they had like cooked it.
Ooh.
So the thing with creative imaginations, sometimes they can be very dark. Especially when I'm watching something like this and then they're not telling me what's going on right away. I start to jump to conclusions very quickly. And also because they were talking about eating babies earlier on and then they kept showing all this meat. Come on, gross. Mia Farrow, fantastic. Cassavetes, fantastic. Oh my God, it was a very pretty movie. I saw some framing, I saw a lot of color, a lot of roses and stuff that I want to look into. I want to look into Tannis root. I feel like I've heard that before. And the fact that they shot this at the Dakota is wild. Oh, it looks like they also did another Rosemary's Baby from 2014. Oh, they made it into a season. I hate that. Shh. I hate that. I like this. I like it as a movie because then you can just get the whole story in like 2 hours. Okay, well, I'm out of here. That was nuts. I enjoyed it though. I'm excited I get to watch it again. I'm excited that I'm able to stream it. And I'm excited to get into it. Okay, bye.
Okay. Yeah, when I first saw this movie, I was like, dude, that was great. You know, I was so excited about it because I was so afraid to watch it that I thought that the movie had to be like, I thought it was going to be like so unbearable and so disturbing and so weird that I wouldn't be able to watch it again. And it was also on a streaming service I already had. So I could watch it as many times as I wanted without having to rent it. And I really did love the costuming. Like I loved the modern day, like 60s styles. And that yellow dress that Mia Farrow wears, like that short yellow dress while she's like, you know, decorating the apartment and stuff, that was hers. That was her actual dress. So that's also just cute that people just dressed so colorfully back then. And the lashes, that was a great time for lashes and eyeliner and makeup and hair. Everyone had like everyone looked like they were wearing wigs. It was great. Oh, and I really loved Ruth Gordon, who played Minnie, the wacky, devil-loving neighbor. She was the best part of the whole film. She was the best part of the whole film. Mia Farrow and John Cassavetes, they were both really good. And I hated John Cassavetes, like his character, because I was supposed to, right? Wow, I hated him so much. And to be honest, I didn't know Cassavetes was an actor. A handsome and a very, very talented actor. I thought he was just a very talented filmmaker. I've only heard about Cassavetes from like any and all film buffs, and I think I might have seen a movie of his before. I don't remember. I don't remember because I was probably like not ready for it. I was very young, I think. I'm not even sure if what I'm remembering even happened. I need to work on my memory. Anyway, Rosemary's Baby. Rosemary's Baby is probably one of the most cursed movies I have ever covered so far. Learning about everything that happened to the cast and crew after the movie came out was wild. Death, divorce, bad luck, murder, And unfortunately, a lot more than that. But I'm not sure if all of this misfortune can be blamed on the movie itself. But it definitely, the movie definitely sent me down a disturbing rabbit hole that I can never fucking forget. Okay, the cursed movie. Let's get on with the curse. What is the curse? Huh? What happened? What happened to all these people? Well, I'm going to take you through it. So let's just start with the author of the story. So Rosemary's Baby is based off a book of the same title that was written by Ira Levin. Some say Ira Levin was cursed because the book came out in 1967, and then the rights were quickly bought by the film's producer, William Castle. The movie goes into production, and while the movie is in production, Ira's marriage starts to fall apart. And then his divorce is finalized the same year the movie came out. And because of the satanic themes of the story and the mockery of the church, Ira was being bullied / harassed by the Catholic Church. The church was sending hate mail and threats. Ain't nothing stronger than Christian hate. Like, the church was flabbergasted at this movie. I don't know why they went to see it. Maybe they should just stick to, I don't know, G-rated movies. G for go and mind your business. G for God. God, please go and mind your fucking business. Anyway, the church freaked Ira out, and he ended up having religious guilt, which is actually pretty intense if you've ever had it. Growing up, I was called a demon by some crusty church lady because I drank the blood of Christ with a straw. I'm still very bitter about it, but like as a child, like they really, the religious guilt, oh my God, oh my God. I grew up with religious guilt. It's heavy. It's crazy. Makes you feel like you're in a cult. Makes you feel like you're in a weird abusive relationship. And I have this whole thing about how God is like the first original abusive boyfriend. And I can go into that later about how God is the first original abusive boyfriend. It's just based on my own experiences. Sorry if God is very personal to you. I'm sure it's a very beautiful relationship. But the relationship I had was absolute church sludge. I hated it. Anyway, so Ira, he was freaked out. And even at the end of his life, he was freaked out. That's not cool. At the end of your life, you're old. And especially if you're passing of old age, like, isn't that the dream, right? We all just like want to like pass away in our sleep after a really long, good life. You know, you're about to pass on to the great beyond. You should be doing literally whatever you want that doesn't cause harm to others, like taking naps and eating whatever you want. Instead, Ira was rattled with religious guilt all the way to the grave. Way to go, you big bullies. Oh, remember William Castle? On to the next cursed being. William Castle, the film's producer. Well, he's the one that found Rosemary's Baby and brought it into production. He also makes a cameo in the movie. He's the guy with the cigar that's waiting outside the phone booth when Rosemary is trying to call Dr. Hill. That was him. Well, he also got a lot of hate mail from God-fearing Christians, and he too got a lot of anxiety from all this intense and hateful attention. The stress was so hard on his body. Y'all, please remember that stress is a physical situation as well as a mental situation. Okay, so please fucking take care of yourself. Well, the stress was so intense that he got severe kidney stones, so he had to get surgery. And during the surgery, he was having hallucinations and even screamed out, "For the love of God, Rosemary, drop that knife!" or something like that. Even though he had surgery to meet his immediate needs, the stress and extreme anxiety and hateful attention left him traumatized. So he had to call an early end to his Hollywood career. Oh my God. Oh my gosh. And on to the next unfortunate soul. Oh man. And the film's composer, Christoph Cometa, he was actually the first death in the roster. I know. Poor Kristoff. He actually fell off a cliff at a party. Yeah, who would have been worried about that at a party? What are the chances? Well, unfortunately, he took a devastating tumble off of a cliff that sent him into a coma, and he passed away at the age of 38, shortly after he finished his work for Rosemary's Baby. And also, Kristoff, your name is spelled so cool. It's K-R-Z-Y-S-T-O-F. That's really cool. Rest in peace, Kristoff. Oh, even the building the movie was based at, the Dakota, collected some monumental dark experiences after the movie. While there is a lot of rumors that the super famous apartment building is super haunted, given the huge personalities that used to live there and that still live there. But in 1980, John Lennon would be returning to his home in the Dakota building only to be murdered right out front by a crazed fan shaking the entire world. Yeah, babe. That's how I know about the Dakota building. And also, once you learn about the Dakota building, it just starts to stick out like a sore thumb when you're like looking around New York City. I don't know. It just sticks out like a sore thumb, but a beautiful sore thumb. It's really pretty. I want to go inside one day. Someone get me in there. I just want to walk around. And Victoria Vetri, the girl in the movie who was the first death in the film, not counting the elderly lady who used to own the apartment Rosemary and Guy moved into, but Victoria Vetri played the part of Terry, the girl who was living with the wacky Satan-worshipping elderly couple, right? And in the laundry room scene, Rosemary asks Terry if she is Victoria Vetri, the actress. And Terry says no, but she gets that all the time. I thought that was cute. It's a cute little Easter egg. But Victoria Vetri, the real person, the actress who plays Terry, she ends up going to prison for attempted murder. Yeah, I think the charge was reduced to a plea agreement or something. But one night she was arguing with her husband and shot him. Girl, she was released from prison in her 70s. Oh, my God. And the next two cursed stories, they just like burn my britches. They make me angry. And you will never guess what meddling weasel makes another appearance on this podcast because he is threatening the production of yet another movie he is not involved in. Frank Sinatra. Get out of here. What are you doing? So let's back up. Mia Farrow, who plays Rosemary and Rosemary's Baby, the leading lady, she was married to Frank Sinatra before and during shooting. So Mia Farrow, she was usually known for her TV work on a soap opera called Peyton's Place, and Rosemary's Baby would be quite the challenging role for her. Oh, but she could handle the Satan stuff. The mental decay of Rosemary, the pregnancy, the pain her character would feel and endure. But it was the nude scenes Mia was worried about. And for good reason. Apparently, Roman Polanski, the director, was one of those directors who slowed down the schedule because he needed to shoot, like, scenes over and over and over again, like around 60 times, before it was just right. Mia had a lot of nude scenes. She wasn't the only one to be nude, but she had the most. Or Rosemary did. Rosemary was nude a lot. Rosemary, there's like shots where there's like bare breasts. She walks in the nude. She was also being required to be fully naked, literally like pussy out and tied to a bed. And, you know, then there's the rape scene, right? So due to Mia's personal boundaries and the multiple retakes Roman was needing, Mia requested for a body double, which is so smart, so smart. You know damn well they did not have consent coaches back then. And a consent coach will sit down with the actors and figure out the guidelines and the boundaries. And the coach will also rush right in when the director calls cut, and the coach will place a robe or a blanket over the nude actor until the team was ready to roll or move on. I know, we love consent coaches and we love body doubles. Round of applause, please, for these super, super, super important people in the biz. Seriously, that's the Lord's work. Thank you so much. Body doubles, stunt doubles, consent coaches, people on set to just make sure that people are safe. We love you. Round of applause. But Lucky, what about Frank Sinatra? What about him? Just kidding. He's a little shit. Well, while Mia Farrow was married to Sinatra, she actually agreed to shoot Frank Sinatra's movie, The Detective, and Rosemary's Baby at the same time. She even gave the Rosemary script to Sinatra to read it and gain his very valued opinion. Mia says that he read the script, snapped it closed, and said that he can't see her playing this part. So no, he didn't give any support or anything of value. No support for Mia to play the leading role of a Hollywood film that would had nothing to do with him. Well, production for Sinatra's movie, The Detective and Rosemary's Baby, happened simultaneously. And Mia was busting her ass to make it work. She was flying back and forth between New York and LA to make this work. She would shoot all week in LA for Rosemary's Baby and then fly to New York on the weekends. Or was it the other way around? Because I know some stuff was like done on a soundstage. The exterior of the Dakota was used. The interior needed to be redone because they needed it. Just nothing was like big enough, I think. Or the apartment layout wasn't specific enough. You know, whatever. So anyway, Mia is like flying back and forth. She's doing all week in LA, weekends in New York. Apparently, Rosemary's Baby was causing too many delays on the detective set. And Frank Sinatra gave his wife, Mia, an ultimatum. He said, "You either do my movie or I'm going to divorce you." Yeah, divorce. Totally skips threatening to kick her off the movie first. He goes straight for the extremely unnecessary kill. That is so emotional. I'm sorry. It is. What are you doing? You're throwing a fit. You're throwing a fit. Like, bat those baby blues somewhere else, dude. Like, relax. Ugh. But Mia had already put in a ton of work with Rosemary's Baby and had a smaller role in The Detective. And she thought that her husband couldn't possibly be serious. Because what the fuck? But he was. Mia continues with Rosemary's Baby against her husband's demands. So Frank Sinatra was sure to send Mia the divorce papers via his attorney while she was on set in front of everyone. Like the attorney had the talk with her in front of everyone. "Mia Farrow, you are being served with divorce papers." Like, Frank Sinatra wanted to humiliate her. She was so shocked and upset. She said that she signed the papers through a blur of tears and doesn't even remember the rest of the day. Apparently, Roman Polanski and his wife, Sharon Tate, had to help Mia recover by inviting her over to their home for some R&R. Yeah, that's right. You heard me. Sharon Tate. So, this movie, fuck you, Frank Sinatra. Anyway, so, I'm sorry, I'm getting my pettiness out now because now shit's gonna get serious. So this moves me on to the next cursed being, or maybe the curse itself, Roman Polanski, the movie's director. Yeah, Roman Polanski was married to Sharon Tate. The Sharon Tate. Okay, so this is the point of the show that calls for that disclaimer from the top of the pod. So if you're not into true crime and learning about disturbing details, go ahead and spare yourself and we'll catch up next week, baby. Much love. See you then. Okay, so now we are going into the heaviest part of the curse. What happened to Sharon Tate was disturbing on a global level, and what Polanski did ended up being disturbing on a controversial and also global level. So if Sharon Tate's name is not familiar to you, maybe the name Charles Manson is. No? Oh, you're one of those sane people who doesn't look into the horrible world of serial killers and cult leaders? Interesting. Well, Charles Manson is a notorious barf cult leader who had the stupid cult called The Family. They are stupid. Y'all are stupid. Long, weird, and very dark story short, because I want to talk more about Polanski. The Family, Charles Manson's cult, they broke into Polanski's home while Sharon and three or four friends resided. Polanski was out of town working on a movie, and he had some friends stay with Sharon because she was 2 weeks out from giving birth. Yeah, 8.5 months pregnant. The Family broke in to the home and killed everyone in the home and brutalized Sharon's pregnant body. People were hung from rafters, blood was everywhere. They even used the blood of their victims to write out their cult sayings on the walls of the home. Roman Polanski was unfortunately the one who found the bodies. This murder was one of the many murders that the Family Manson cult committed in such a short time frame. They targeted Hollywood elite, and they were sending disturbing messages to the police and the world. It was devastating and absolutely a nightmare for Sharon's survivors, like her family and her husband. The press was all over this story and helped spread the word, but also added a lot of speculation to the situation and pressure to Polanski and Sharon Tate's family. This all happened 1 year after the release of Rosemary's Baby, and people felt horrible for Roman and Tate's family. Honestly, I had no idea that he was Sharon Tate's husband. I had no idea that she was married to him. And then I was confused by why I never really heard about him in regards to this case. You know, like, I have heard of Roman Polanski before, but it was only in praise for his movies. People made his movies sound like fine aged wine. Rosemary's Baby was his first American film that ended up being a blockbuster. Take that, Frank Sinatra! Detective who? I don't know. Some people even speculate that there are a lot of similarities to Rosemary's Baby and how Sharon Tate was murdered. So I have seen documentary after documentary about the Manson family. It's been a while, but still, I didn't know too much about Roman Polanski. I was like, what? He was the husband? Like, you know, what? So I looked into him to see whatever happened to this guy. And then I fucking found out why this lame ass is never around. Let's get into it. Here we go. Hold on to your fucking butts. So I looked into Roman Polanski. And you know, I saw that he escaped the Holocaust, but his parents weren't so lucky. I saw that his skull was cracked open by some guy who said he was going to buy Roman's bike, but he actually ends up beating the shit out of Roman and stealing his bike and all of his money. And then it also turns out that guy was a serial killer, and Roman like goes off to make a movie about it. And then I learned about the experience with his wife's passing. And then I learned that he's a child rapist. Yeah. God, where do we fucking start with this? When I saw the child rape case, my head spun around 3 times. I'm still recovering. Thanks for asking. You're really sweet. My brain was trying to find out how he goes from America's biggest fascination and sweetheart to violent sex offender. Turns out there was probably no true transition, and that Roman's actions actually show that he was always like this. Okay, so I'll tell you what I found out in the order I found it. Okay, So I was excited to look into the director because usually this is the fun, fascinating part. I get to find out their inspirations. I get to find out all this like cool direction-y stuff, Artur stuff, like symbolism. And then I get to watch the movie all over again and then it hits completely differently. It's like one of my favorite parts about doing this podcast. So when I was looking into Roman Polanski, y'all, I got three paragraphs in when I saw the link to his sex offender case. Three paragraphs. And the wiki page for his crime is literally the same size as his wiki page about his life and career. So it all began in 1977. Remember, the movie came out in 68. Sharon Tate was murdered in 69. So some time has passed. So it all began in 1977 when Roman Polanski was asked to be a guest editor for Paris Vogue. Polanski asked this actress slash model, whose name I can't find, if he can take photos of her aspiring model 13-year-old daughter. The mother agreed to a private shoot. Maybe it shouldn't have been private, but maybe the mom said yes to a private shoot because of trust or wanted her daughter to have privacy. I don't know. It was also the 70s, so the norm, especially in Hollywood, was really like fast and loose living, you know, like all love, man, hippy dippy, trust everyone, peace, love kind of shit. And Hollywood, I'm telling you, it really embraced this side because it's a party lifestyle. And Polanski really loved that free love, man, kind of lifestyle. So he has this shoot at Jack Nicholson's house. Jack Nicholson is out of town in Colorado for a ski trip. The 13-year-old aspiring model, we'll call her Sam. Her name is Samantha, but we'll call her Sam. Her name is public, but I don't know if anyone's business should be put on blast right now. It's Roman's, so I'm going to be using his first and last name until the cows come home. So Sam, she agrees to do this shoot. She goes over to Nicholson's house and does a photo shoot. That makes her uncomfortable because Roman Polanski requested that she participate in some topless photo shoots. Like, he wanted to take pictures of her topless right then and there. And she agrees because, again, there's like a power dynamic going on. Hello, there's a huge power dynamic going on. It's a kid and an adult. It's an aspiring model and a really famous director shooting for Vogue. They're at Jack Nicholson's house. Like, I'm very sure she feels powerless in this situation. So she agrees, probably reluctantly and out of fear and discomfort, to do the topless photos. This makes her uncomfortable. That photo shoot, you know, it's over. She goes home. And Roman actually requested that she come back for a second shoot. She didn't want to go back, but, you know, she is trying her best. And it's Hollywood. And the culture of Hollywood is very grueling for aspiring women. And also the lines are very blurred on who is a child and who is a woman. It's really gross. It's Holly weird, for real. Like, we hear stories all the time of what women had to go through just to get a job or prevent themselves from being blacklisted. So she goes back, right? And this time, Polanski is taking shots of Sam drinking champagne. She's 13. I know in the 70s, all the kids were smoking and drinking by like age 5, but this is weird. This is weird. Private shoot, champagne, requesting the removal of clothes. She's 13 and he's 43. He's 43. I'm getting angry. I'm getting fucking angry. Okay. So he serves her champagne and then he gives her quaaludes. And tells her that he wants to move the photo shoot into the bedroom. So Sam reports that she told him no, that she didn't want to go into the bedroom. But he convinces her, apparently. Like, he didn't, like, physically force her into the bedroom, but she did protest about going into the bedroom. So she goes into the bedroom. And that is when Roman Polanski rapes this 13-year-old girl vaginally and anally. And also gave her oral sex against her will. I don't like calling it oral sex because it's rape. If it's not consensual, it's not sex. She told the courts and interviews that she protested and she said no. did not give consent and was afraid and waited till it was over so she could go home. So during the attack, Angelica Houston apparently was there. Angelica Houston was dating and living with Jack Nicholson at the time, and Sam says in a later interview that Angelica actually came home, you know, while Polanski and Sam were in the bedroom, and Angelica was, like, suspicious of the closed bedroom door, and she's even banging on it, demanding to know what's going on, and Polanski is like, "We're just finishing up the photo shoot, just a moment," or whatever. Dumbass. I can't stand him. He's gross. He's predatory. He's dangerous. He's evil. He's unforgivable. Honestly, unforgivable. The next day, Roman says he was at his hotel when he was greeted by police officers who present him with the accusations, and then the legal process begins. One of the longest legal battles I have seen in a bit, y'all. So the legal drama starts. It's in the press and it's all over the news. Roman is charged with multiple accounts that would absolutely categorize him as a criminal child rapist and sex offender. At first, he doesn't plead guilty. And apparently Sam, she wanted to spare herself from a long and very public legal process. And she agrees with her lawyer to give Roman a plea deal for a lesser charge of unlawful sex with a minor under 14. His original charges included the drug, the rape, of the vaginal rape, the anal rape, like all of it, like just everything he did to her. He had like six counts of it. And then they reduced it to just one count of unlawful sex with a minor under 14. And he pleads guilty to this. That's important. So he pleads guilty to this charge. So now it's time to wait for the sentencing hearing. In the meantime, Roman Polanski is ordered to go to prison for 90 days to get a psychiatric eval. But before the eval, he was granted permission to do the eval after he finishes whatever project he was working on. That is freaking crazy because this is a violent crime against a child. Anyway, I also think he was like on parole at this time. Either way, he knew he had to be on his best behavior if he is even capable of that. Like, I don't even want to know what his best behavior looks like. Disgusting little creep. So Polanski is off working on this project when he is photographed at Oktoberfest. We are still in 1977, and he is still expected back in California for a psychiatric eval. While he's out on this granted field trip, he is photographed being all over and around young women, quote unquote, and alcohol. So the California judge sees this and is like, tell him to get back here and do his 90-day evaluation now. Polanski comes back and he does the evaluation, but only serves 45 out of the 90 days. That is half. Before his sentencing hearing, his parole officers send the court a 28-page report that said Polanski was a creative genius and that Polanski is from a different land with different morals. And of course, placed some blame on the victim and the mother, and even said, quote, that the victim was not only physically mature, but willing. I'm sorry. One second. The report also stated that the two psychiatrists who evaluated Polanski said he was not a pedophile or a sexual deviant. God, jeez, I'm so sorry. There's just something stuck in my... What do you fucking mean? What do you mean he's there for raping a 13-year-old? Jeez, it is like my allergies. I'm like allergic to pedophiles. It's crazy. Whew. Anyway, well, Polanski's legal team thought that he was going to get off with probation because the psychiatrists, parole officers, and even the victim, remember that she's a traumatized child, said that prison time wasn't recommended. So the judge had a meeting with these parole officers. This wasn't the sentencing hearing. The judge had a meeting with the parole officers in regards to their 28-page letter. And this is what he said about this meeting, and I quote, "I told them that I had carefully read it and that I felt it was superficial, replete with many inaccuracies and factually unsupported conclusions, and was conspicuous more for what it failed to report than what it did report. I believe I used the word whitewash. I stated that there was absolutely no mention in the report of any discussions which the counselors and psychiatrists at Chino," that was the prison, "had with Mr. Polanski relating to the serious and aggravated charges of rape by drugs and alcohol, sodomy, and oral copulation of the 13-year-old victim. I believe I pointed out to them that the statement in the report..." Now the judge is quoting something from the report. This is what the report, that 28-page report, said. This statement was in there. "That throughout the experience with the victim, Mr. Polanski seems to have been unaware that he was involving himself in a criminal offense, an isolated instance of naivety, unusual in a mature, sophisticated man," end quote, dicks. The judge goes on to say, "was one of the most fattiest statements in a diagnostic report that I have ever read. I told Mr. Dalton that I did not propose to follow the recommendations, which were for straight probation without any additional time in custody." Thank you, Judge. The only professional. So what did Judge Reitenband suggest he was going to do? The judge said he was going to put him in prison and deport him. Yeah, because, dude, what the hell? I'm going to be real with y'all. I wasn't blown away by the direction in Rosemary's Baby. And the story was already written by Ira. So it's not like he came up with the story, you know? Polanski didn't come up with that. And he also seemed like a mess. I know it was his first U.S. film, but he was 10 days late on the 10th day of production and had to shoot stuff over and over and over again. And that boob shot on the boat was weird. Like, we didn't need to be in her boobs to know she was naked. It just wasn't a creative choice. Like, I don't have any issue with nudity, and like, and we've already talked about the body doubles and stuff, so everybody was like very consensual about it, but it just wasn't creative. And Cassavetes, I'm so sorry if I'm saying his name wrong, he was getting annoyed with Polanski. And honestly, and I thought a lot of things were campy about the movie, and I love camp. I love it. And it turns out that the campy moments, like the knife drop at the end, for example, were actually results from Polanski's super stiff and strict, like, directing style. I don't think he was like an asshole during shooting, but it was very strict. I would call the movie and the directing fun at best. Genius? That's a bit generous. I know this all happened a few years after his masterpiece, I probably can't even watch now, Chinatown. And it was a few years after that movie came out, and Chinatown, you know, like, everybody loves it. And I also saw The Pianist when I was way too fucking young. I was way too fucking, it scarred me, as it should. It's dark. And it sucks that, like, Polanski has those experiences, like, those are his childhood memories. Like, that sucks. I'm not denying that. But I know Pianist was, like, I know that movie was good because of the acting, you know? And I'm kind of wondering if that's also the case in Chinatown. Even though the story, the Chinatown story does sound good, and I know he, like, wrote it with the assistance of someone else, I can't remember. But, and it's, like, film noir. Like, I know it's probably delicious, but again, I don't know if I can watch it. Because no, I can't separate the art from the artist when the artist is a child rapist. His movies are not that good to make me forget about a child rapist. And I don't need to see his movies to say that. Like, I don't need to. Like, that statement stands for everybody. If you're a child rapist, I don't want to see your shit. I don't. You're gross. You're weird. And you should be studied, because this is also a huge problem that we have in this country. Pedophilia. What the hell is going on? Like, what the actual fuck? And this whole question of, can we separate the art from the artist, is such a waste of time to me. Like, why am I allowed to take the art personally, but not the disturbing, gross, stupid behavior of the artist personally? Like, why is that in question? And why do these artists get these privileges? I don't even want to call them artists. It's just these people, these monsters. Why do these monsters get these privileges? That is a privilege. Every time we ask this question, it's usually about a rich person, about a really well-known person. Nowadays, this argument is reserved for rich artists who abuse their power and other people, like children. Oh, God, and we're also just, like, finding out about so much right now. And you know what? It's not like you and I get a get-out-of-jail-free card just because we're really good at our day job. You know what I mean? Fuck these shitheads. And then to call him a genius, that's not genius to me. And also, it's like, out of everybody from Rosemary's Baby, like, William Castle, his career ended because he was traumatized from the backlash he got for just making a book into a movie. But Roman Polanski were like, I don't know. Ugh. Well, not all of it. A lot of us, I will say, a lot of us don't like him. And when I went on Reddit and I, like, was really happy to see that everybody was calling him a piece of shit. And I'm like, okay, thank God. Woo! But the people that are still calling him a genius, what is wrong with you? Honestly, what is wrong with you? Is that's genius to you? That's not genius to me. Mm-mm. Anyway, this shit gets weirder because many countries now get involved in this case. So Polanski gets wind that the judge is actually planning to bring him into custody. And he goes on the run. He runs. He makes a break for it. He's a flight risk. He leaves town. He leaves the country. And he makes himself into a fugitive and hides out in countries that won't turn him over to the U.S. Polanski lives his life freely and makes one hell of a career, and even doubles down on his interest in quote-unquote young girls. And he also goes on record to be like, the girl was 2 weeks away from 14. Bitch, shut up. Anyway, he goes on to live his life freely and makes one hell of a career, winning awards in the U.S. and around the world as if he isn't a gross fucking monster for the next 32 years. Then, in 2009. This is a good part of this insane story. So, Roman is to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award in Switzerland, right? Switzerland Film Festival, 2009. So he goes off to Switzerland to get this Lifetime Achievement Award, only to be stopped and detained at the Zurich airport because Switzerland was like, wait, you're wanted for what? Ew, gross. Go to jail. It was probably like more formal than that. But basically, they knew that he was a wanted man and put him in jail. And thus starts Polanski's year-long and super public battle to get out of jail and prevent going to the U.S. for his consequences. Idiot! You're haunted by your own demons. You are your own demon, weird ass. Anyway, so there is a lot of back and forth between all these countries, like France, because he had a citizenship in France, and then in the U.S., then Switzerland. There was public outcry from all three countries. All the rich people, like politicians, some ministers, actors and directors were calling for his release. I know that his victim was also calling for his forgiveness, but let's remember that she is traumatized and this shit has been on the global stage since she was 13. I don't want to discredit anything that she says or feels, like, no matter what she says. Like, I believe that what she's saying is what she's feeling. I'm not discrediting anything that she's saying. I am just allowing a lot of space for Sam to feel and express all the emotions and thoughts. Dude, it should not be her responsibility to sentence or speak on behalf of this grown-ass narcissistic man, right? Of her attacker. She also sued him in 1988, go girl, and they settled out of court. So I do believe that she might feel that she is taken care of, that she did get closure, you know? If that's her experience, that's her experience. But dealing with trauma can be unpredictable. And if she decides to take back everything she said tomorrow, I would accept it and I would get it. And if she decided to double down, I also accept that and I also get it as well. Like, I understand. It's a very complicated place to be when you're a victim of something like that. But for countries to show total support of a child rapist because he made some movies they like is absolutely bleak, heartbreaking, and infuriating. Also, if y'all love his movie so damn much, how come his highest rating on IMDb is like 8.5? Like, 3 out of his shit ton of movies is above an 8. Only 3 of them are. The rest of his movies are like rated 6 or lower. I know that the internet was not a thing always. People are still having this discussion if he's an artistic genius or if his criminal career is too distracting to even enjoy his movies. And it's just like, if he's a genius, 8.5, you know, not even a 9.5, a genius. I don't know. God, anyway. So Polanski is locked up for about a year and petition after petition was signed for his release. And when they were petitioning for him to be released, a lot of A-listers signed it. But then people were finding out the nitty-gritty of his charges, and then people just started pulling their names off of these petitions. And I don't blame them for signing these petitions. I know, hold on, wait. So these petitions were going out in 2009, and we're talking about MySpace versus Facebook era social media. So people weren't talking like how we can talk today. Like, the world cannot talk to each other like we can today. And back then, we didn't use the internet to research people who were still alive. You know, we watched MTV and the 6 o'clock news for that. And we could hardly text. The buttons were so fucking squishy. Anyway, these petitions weren't honest, by the way. They don't even talk about the crimes that he did. One petition in France read that he was being held for outdated charges related to a moral conflict or something, making him sound like an edgy artist. Here's an example of one of the petitions from France. Apprehended like a common terrorist Saturday evening, September 26th, as he came to receive a prize for his entire body of work, Roman Polanski now sleeps in prison. He risks extradition to the United States for an episode that happened years ago, and whose principal plaintiff repeatedly and emphatically declares she has put it behind her and abandoned any wish for legal proceedings. 76 years old, a survivor of Nazism and of Stalinist persecutions in Poland, Roman Polanski risks spending the rest of his life in jail for deeds which would be beyond the statute of limitations in Europe. We ask the Swiss courts to free him immediately and not to turn this ingenious filmmaker into a martyr of politico-ligo-imbro... I cannot say this word. Imbroligo. Imbroglio. Imbroglio. That is unworthy of two democracies like Switzerland and the United States. Good sense, as well as honor, requires it. Yeah, what? So no one, including Polanski, throughout this entire clusterfuck, denied the charges. I know he pled not guilty at first, and I know he denies some shit in his autobiography, but in court, he pled guilty after being charged. So the statute of limitations does not exist in this case because he pled guilty. A lot of back and forth continues. The French government eventually withdraws their support. And Polanski proposed to the Swiss government a plea where he could be released on a $4.5 million bail and then to be on house arrest in his French chalet until further progression in the case. Yeah, the Swiss government agreed to this. But, you know, there was a lot of drama on how to actually get him from Switzerland to the U.S., like if Switzerland agrees to, like, release him to be extradited. So he pays this $4.5 million bail, and he goes on house arrest, and he collects his cute little ankle bracelet, and then he goes off to this chalet to rot. I don't know. And Eventually, the U.S. makes a request to extradite Polanski back to the U.S. for sentencing. But the U.S. screwed up the fucking paperwork, and also the court system in the U.S. came to the conclusion that the 45 days in prison added with the time held in Switzerland counts as time served for his crimes, and he's basically set free. Barely a year and 45 days for all of this, for all of this. Like, he's 75. He did this shit when he was 43. I'm still not sure if that means he can come back here, but that's where this fucker has been. I think he is a creep, and that was not enough time for what he did. I also hate how cocky he is about it all. Like, he made a movie called What? Like, literally, it was called What? So this movie called What came out in 1972, and there is a movie poster for this movie that reads, quote, "The erotic fantasies of the world's most notorious director." And I know this movie is categorized as a comedy, and I know that's probably like satirical, but it's also, he's a narcissist, and narcissists talk. And when they talk, they confess. Because also, I don't think he's that smart. Because when you're a dumb narcissist, you confess all the time without even knowing it. And so I think The Erotic Fantasies of the World's Most Notorious Director, that's a good example of that. It's supposed to be a comedy, but basically it's about a young girl on a weird island, and she's like constantly being sexually harassed and assaulted. Yeah, that's totally hilarious. I'm just another girl without a sense of humor. I wish you could see my face right now. It's chilling. That movie also seemed humiliating for the actress. Like, she's running around naked all the time because people keep stealing her clothes. And then there's this like old director in the movie. It's just weird. I'm telling you, that entire movie's a confession. It's weird. Also, he has a track record of being with women who are way younger than him. Obviously. Sharon Tate. Sharon Tate was 10 years younger than him and married him when she was 24. I know that might not seem extreme to most. Like, my grandparents might be 10 or 11 years apart. My parents are like 6 years apart. But in this case, I think it is significant when you look at their relationship. Also, he treated her disrespectfully. He cheated on her all the time. She made it clear that she wanted a traditional marriage, and he complained that he wanted a hippie and not a housewife. Basically being like, I want to sleep with anyone I want. And Tate, she was even quoted saying, we have a good arrangement. Roman lies to me and I pretend to believe him. That's one way to get an STD. Mm-hmm. That's one way for him to get all these people pregnant and like not even commit to the children that he's going to make. And he even goes on to sue Vanity Fair for putting out an article about how he was trying to pick up women on the way to Tate's funeral. Like, he won the case. But honestly, when these guilty men just start suing people for defamation, another confession, like, I have seen a handful of rich, powerful men who are so obviously guilty, or at the very least, disgustingly slimy and predatorial. Like, they use their money, their power, their influence to file and win defamation cases, especially against their victims. Yes, Johnny Depp, I'm looking at you. That was disgusting. And I was a huge Johnny Depp fan. No more. That was weird. Weird. And I watched that case minute by minute, dude. Weird. And that's not the only defamation case for Polanski. There are a few more after his main case is basically concluded. This man goes after so many people for talking about him. It just screams suspicious that he is obsessed with himself. And at the age of 90, he is due to deal with another sexual abuse case against him in 2025. He's not even done yet. Oh, and if that isn't enough for you, he had a lot of weird interviews. So there was this one interview with Martin Amis where they were talking about the trial. And this little worm says, quote, "If I had killed somebody, it wouldn't have had so much appeal to the press, you see. But fucking, you see, and the young girls, judges want to fuck young girls, juries want to fuck young girls, everybody wants to fuck young girls." Yeah. Ugh. That makes my blood turn cold, even just saying that quote. And then in the 80s, when he had another interview and he opened his shit mouth and he said, quote, I like girls of that age. And because the girls of that age, for some reason, like me. No, they don't. And then the interviewer said, okay, granted that you have this interest in young girls and have never concealed that you have this interest in young girls, wasn't an incident like the one that happened more or less bound to happen eventually? And Polanski responded, looking back at it, it probably was bound to happen. Yes. I watched that interview and it is so weird. It is so hard to sit through. It is because he's just so nonchalant about it. He's so nonchalant about it. He doubles down on being a pedophile. He doubles down on calling children young women. He doubles down on saying that 13-year-old girls look like women, so that justifies all of his fucking actions. He's disgusting. Oh, and his current wife is 32 years younger than him. Patterns. Patterns. Yuck. And also his wife is completely like brainwashed by him and totally like doubles down right along with him. Girl, you're lost in the sauce. I hope you can come out of it by the time you're 60 and enjoy the rest of your life. I don't know. What movie were we talking about? Right. Rosemary's Baby. Well, yeah, I can't watch this movie ever again without thinking about what he did. Because in the movie, Rosemary is drugged and raped. It's just, it's too weird, dude. It's too weird. Okay, now let's conclude things. We did it, my darlings. Sorry this one wasn't really fun. Originally, after I found out all this disturbing and infuriating stuff, I almost just wanted to pick another movie. But that made me feel like I was doing Roman Polanski a favor. I know my podcast is really small, but still, I had no idea that this was going on. And maybe some of y'all had no idea too, even though it kind of sounds like I'm the last person in the world to find all this stuff out. But at least now we all know. And I think it's important to show stories like this as an example of how the American justice system works for people who have money or power, or God forbid, both, especially when it comes to sex crimes and crimes committed against children. I also wanted to show how easy it is to be sold a story about a certain case, even on a global scale, and how some of the biggest atrocities can be overlooked and covered up effortlessly just for the sake of a celebrity's career. If you're conflicted with a celebrity that let you down, you know, I am in the same boat with you. Luckily, I did not give a shit about Roman Polanski, except for like maybe about 5 minutes. But, you know, my heart's been broken a lot by these celebrities who are showing their true colors. And, you know, all I can say to you, my love, is I hope that another artist who actually deserves your support and attention gives you inspiration to last lifetimes. And it makes you forget all about the careless imposters who wronged you and so many others. Man, do y'all remember Gremlins? That was so fun. Fake potato snow and real chainsaws. Is that too much to ask for, Hollywood? God. Alrighty, babies. I truly thank you for walking through this one with me, and I appreciate you so much. And that was the episode on Rosemary's Baby. What the fuck? What the absolute fuck? I screamed. I screamed a lot during that one. That one made me very angry. But it is something that it needs to be talked about. People are abusing their power. And you know, and he was cocky about it. He was cocky about it. He was cocky about all the fucking shit that he did. He thought he was cool for what he did. Ew. And now we got the shit going on with Diddy and, like, geez Louise and, God. I don't know what else to say. I don't know what to say. Yeah, remember Gremlins? Oh my gosh. Well, next week, I don't know how true crime people do it. Like, how do you, how? Anyway, so next week, I'm going to be digging into Candyman for the very first time. I've never seen Candyman, and even just talking about him lifts my spirits just a little bit because he's like a new folklore that I learned about. Like, he's a new spirit that I learned about. So that was kind of cool. There's also some other true crime stuff about Candyman as well, but we'll get into it. It's going to be another heavy episode, but still more stuff we got to talk about. And at least with Candyman, nothing happened to where I won't watch it again and again and again. If anything, I'm going to keep watching it again and again and again and again. All right, if you want to figure all that out, join me next Monday right here on Lucky's Really Long List of Movies, where I tackle my list of movies that I've never seen before, and I also make dumb little videos about my reactions and poster predictions, so feel free to follow me on Instagram at lucky.damn.day and on TikTok at lucky.damn.day and anywhere else? I don't know. I might go on YouTube soon. I think I've said that before. But yeah. Okay. All right. That's enough for me. Bye. Drink some water and stop trusting these rich people.